So what I thought we'd do is I'd talk for a while, probably about 45 minutes, something like that, and then there's a bit of time if there's any questions at the end. So if there's anything that I say that's not clear you'd like to ask about at the end, then please save your questions up for the end. And I'll try to leave some time for it. So you're doing a series on heroes, spiritual heroes of the Buddhist tradition. And it's highly suitable in a way that Milarepa should be considered one of those heroes. Just initially, I'd like to see how many people are familiar with Milarepa. Not just heard of him, but are familiar. Okay, 50%, probably something like that. So I hope that for those that you are familiar, you don't find this too repetitive. And for those of you that are new to him, I hope you get something of a taste of him. I'm going to talk about him for 2 weeks this week. I'm going to talk about his life. And then next week, I'm going to talk about his teaching and the relevance of his teaching to us today in the modern West. So why is Milarepa of interest to us particularly? He's known as the great yogi saint of Tibet. But why should he be of interest to us? There are a number of reasons, I think. One reason I thought of is that if we're interested in Buddhism, then we're going to, in the West at this time, then we're going to be influenced to some degree or another by Tibetan Buddhism. Tibetan Buddhism is quite strong, or at least the Western offshoots of it are quite strong in the West. And so Tibetan Buddhism is very much part of our Western Buddhist culture. It has its influences in our Western Buddhist culture. And in Tibetan Buddhist culture, there are three very important teachers, very important founders of traditions, which go right back to the 6th and the 11th century of the Common Era. So it's important in a way to know something about all three of these great, great Buddhist teachers. On the one hand, we have Padmasambhava, we have Milarepa, and we have Atisha. Padmasambhava wasn't the first to take Buddhism to Tibet, but he was the first to really establish Buddhism in Tibet in about the 8th, 9th century. Before Buddhism went to Tibet, Tibetan was mainly, the tradition there was the Bon tradition, which is a sort of magical tradition with lots of ritual. So it's a very ritualistically based magical tradition. So the kind of Buddhism that Padmasambhava introduced, which would meld in well with that culture, was also very ritualistic. Tantric Buddhism, which Padmasambhava represents, involves a lot of use of ritual. It communicates the Dharma through very long pujas, through very long, complex ceremonies and ritual practices. So Padmasambhava is associated with Tantric Buddhism. He's associated with ritual. And that has always been a very strong current running through Tibetan Buddhism from the 800s right up till today. He was followed in the 11th century by Atisha. Now, Atisha was a slightly different sort of character. He was a monk and he was a scholar. So the teaching that he introduced to Tibet was called Lam Rin. Lam Rin means the graduated path. And it's a systematized presentation of the Buddha's teaching. So it's quite doctrinal. The early Lam Rins were fairly short. You can get one of Atisha's Lam Rins, it's about that big, and that's a description of the whole of the Buddha's path in a very systematic, analytical manner. Later on, Tsongkhapa comes along, and his Lam Rin is about this thick. This is about, 15th century, something like that, I'm not quite sure. But again, the same tradition, this idea of taking all of the Buddha's teaching and presenting it in a very systematic manner, the whole of the teaching in this very systematic, scholarly, doctrinal sort of manner. So you've got Padmasambhava teaching through ritual and ceremony and mantra and magic. You've got Atisha teaching through scholarly understanding of the Dharma through a systematic presentation of the whole of the Buddha's teaching. And then, a little bit after Atisha, you've got Milarepa coming along. And Milarepa is really known for meditation. He's very simple. He's very straightforward. He's a sort of Zen master of Tibetan Buddhism. By the time Milarepa comes along, there's a lot of scholars around, following in Atisha's tradition, who understand the Dharma very, very thoroughly. They understand all the metaphysics, all the psychology. They understand these things very, very well. But they don't actually practice it. Yeah. This is the problem with scholars. Scholars, you know, nice enough chaps and chapesses and so on. But there is a tendency just to sort of study and get understand it, but not really sort of practice it, not make it real. And the tantricists, with all of their ritual and all of their magic and so on, well, that by this time there was a lot of them that were really just sort of, well, no more than local sorcerers, really. They weren't really communicating the Dharma. They were just doing the rituals, going through the ritual procedures, but not with a really vital spiritual dimension to them. So Milarepa, in a way, comes into this milieu and in a very, very simple, straightforward way, he tells people how it is, very, very directly, and emphasizes meditation. So this, in a way, is his particular characteristic. He's not a scholar, although he does understand the Dharma. He's not a tantric practitioner, although he is perfectly at ease with magic, as we'll see in a minute. But he really is presenting the Dharma in a very uncompromising and direct way. We can say that he emphasizes really three things. Primarily renunciation. He says happiness cannot be found in the world, therefore leave it. Yeah, he doesn't say, you know, just leave it a little bit. He says leave it, leave the world behind. If you want liberation, leave the world behind. Leave behind your family, leave behind your career, leave behind your house, leave behind everything, and go off into the mountains. Not a popular teaching. Not popular today, and it wasn't popular in his time either. But that, ladies and gentlemen, is the bottom line. That is really what Buddhism's all about. It's about renouncing samsara, about renouncing the world. We'll say more about that later. This kind of teaching is not easy. It requires a lot of effort. So this is the other thing that Milarepa represents. He doesn't represent an easy teaching. He represents the kind of teaching where you have to really work hard, make a lot of effort. Sometimes, you know, you read some books on Buddhism these days and you're just told to sort of, you know, you're there anyway, you know, just realize your liberation and you know, that's it. But that isn't actually how it really works. What is necessary is quite a lot of hard work, quite a lot of hard personal work. So Milarepa also represents this. So he's really a hero in this kind of way. He represents uncompromising renunciation and uncompromising effort into one spiritual practice. Sounds a bit tough, doesn't it? You know, kind of sounds a bit heavy, a bit sort of bleak. But Milarepa is also well known for his appreciation of nature, of his love of nature. A lot of his teachings are really just songs of praise to the beauty that he finds around him. He sings about the joy of liberation. He sings about the joy of the mountains. He's always talking about the bird song and the monkeys playing in the trees and the wonderful colours of the trees and the clouds and the eagles and the fish. And so he's really, really appreciative of his environment. So his love of nature, his joy of his liberation, kind of stands in contrast to all this rather sort of what could seem quite heavy. So his is a joyful life, and he continually emphasises that. He says it requires a lot of effort, but it is ultimately a very highly joyful life. So these are some of his qualities. We'll be going into these a bit more next week, if I haven't frightened you away sufficiently, to see them in a bit more detail. So in a way, he's the archetype of what has been called the forest renunciant. A few years ago, actually about 25 years ago, a chap called Reginald Ray, an American academic practitioner, wrote a book called Buddhist Saints in India. And in this book, he outlined the three main categories of the Sangha. He said that the Buddhist spiritual community, the Sangha, is made up of three types of practitioners. There are lay practitioners who practice Buddhism within the context of an ordinary or kind of ordinary lay life. They have their families, they have their careers, they have their homes and all the rest of it. So there's the lay practitioners. Then there's the monastics. He calls them monastic renunciants, I think. But anyway, it's the monastics. It's the people that live in institutions. They lived in the monasteries. So they've renounced the world to a certain extent, but they're still living within a Buddhist religious institutional life. So they have the kind of the support of that. And then you've got the forest renunciants, who are actually more like the Buddha, and they just go off and live in the forest. They don't live in a monastery or a vihara. They just go off and live in the forests, in the mountains, sometimes in small bands of two or three, four or five people, but nothing organized, no buildings, no structure. They just live kind of wild. And Reginald Ray makes the point that these three communities are all essential. All three of them are essential to a healthy Buddhist community. You need the lay community to provide sort of a connection with the world. And the lay people will usually support the monastics, support some amongst their numbers to live, as it were, a full-time, dedicated spiritual life. But you also need the kind of lunatic fringe, these people that sort of go off and live in the mountains and take the whole thing deadly serious and really want to pursue it in that kind of way. Because they revitalise. The experience that the forest renunciants, that the hermits in the mountains have, is fresh. It's always fresh and new and vibrant. And they bring that back into the spiritual community. I don't want to wander too far away from my topic, but when this book came out, somebody asked Sangharakshita, well, how can we live a forest renunciant life? Because, you know, you can't really, you know, take off into the new forest and sort of be a hermit and live there all your life. Although some people try it, I must say. And he said he thought it was the artists who were the forest renunciants. Now, I must say, I didn't quite understand that at the time, but I've been reflecting on it for the last 25 years. And just recently, I think I've come to some sort of understanding of what he means. a genuine artist, by which I mean somebody who's devoted to really experiencing reality in some depth and then working that out within their own life. You know, they're not in it, into it for the money or the fame or whatever. They're really going deeply into themselves and trying to express that depth. Well, such people have to do that by themselves. They can't do it with other people. They have to go off. They have to, you know, writers, painters, composers, they all work in a very, very much by themselves within their own world. So they're not so much part of a community to that extent. Do you see what I mean? So I think this is something of the Forest Renunciant. The Forest Renunciant is the one that sort of pursues the spiritual life for themselves, by themselves, and hopefully something of that will spin off into the world. It's quite often said that you know, hermits and renunciants and so on are a bit selfish because they just go off and do their own thing and they don't care about anybody else. I think Buddhist renunciants, sure, they go off, they do their own thing, but they do care, they do have compassion. Now, they may not seem to be particularly active. In a way, Milarepa, as we'll learn, he didn't start anything. He didn't start any institutions. He didn't have a temple. He didn't create anything like that. But here, 1,000 years later, in a completely different culture, here we are talking about him. And some of us are very deeply inspired by him. So the effect of him living that life reverberates through the ages and all around the world, without him actually doing anything sort of concretely to make that happen. Do you see what I mean? It's almost the sort of the magic of the romantic poets, for example. They didn't set anything up. They didn't do anything except write poetry, except do what they wanted to do. But look at what effect that they've had on our Western culture. Anyway, again, we might come back to that later. So Milarepa, if you like, is the archetype of the Forest Renunciant. I believe that within all of us there is a Forest Renunciant. You know, we've all heard of the kind of, what's it, the infant within or something?
Inner child.
The inner child, right. So forget the inner child. It's the inner renunciant you want to connect. You know, it's that part deep inside you that really responds to this idea of finally being free, giving up all of those ties and bonds that you have, having the courage to let them go and just be free. Renunciation is about being free. That's what it's about. It's about letting go of things so that you can be free, so that you can fly like the darkies. Anyway, Milarepa is this kind of character. He's freedom personified. He's challenging, because when we read about him or when we reflect upon him, he reminds us, he touches that renunciant within. He touches something deep within us, and it stimulates that. But that then bangs against our lives, you know. You think, how can I possibly do this? How can I possibly give up all these things? You know, my life is so sort of embedded in all this stuff. Of course I can't get free. But Milarepa's saying, yeah, you can. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. No, I can't. Yes, you can. No, I can't. So you get this kind of inner spiritual conflict. An inner spiritual conflict is one of the best things you can have for spiritual life. It's something that actually moves you on. It's not something to be afraid of. You could almost say that if there's no spiritual conflict, then there's no spiritual life. If you don't feel a kind of tension between liberation and the bondage of samsara, then you're not really on the cutting edge. So today we're going to talk about his life, just look at his life and see what, in a way, get a model, if you like, of what the renunciant life might be like in its highs and its lows. Where does this information come from? Well, there are two primary texts. One is called the Milarepa, which is the life story of Milarepa, and one is called the Milagrupa, which is the collection of his teachings, which are gathered together in the form of various songs of poetry that he is said to have delivered in his lifetime. Both of these books were written down about... they were written down in about 1200. Milarepa was alive until about 1140. So I always think the Battle of Hastings, he was around teaching. Well, he wasn't quite teaching, actually. No, he was doing other things then. But during the Battle of Hastings, Milarepa was was an active magician at that time. We'll come to this later. So, but Battle of Hastings, that's the sort of time we're talking about. The life story and the teachings, the songs, were written down about 80 years after his death by one of his main disciple, who was called the Insane Yogi of Sun. So let's look at his life. As I said, the date, there are a number of different dates, of course, for his life, but I believe the commonly accepted one is about 1052 until 1135. So very much around the time of the last invasion of this fair land. Buddhism had been introduced into Tibet 700 years before that, but there'd been a very difficult history. It got very involved with politics very early on. So there were some kings who sided with Buddhism. When they were on the throne, Buddhism thrived. Other kings sided with the Bon tradition, the previous tradition. When they were in power, then the Buddhists were persecuted. So it was a very up and down sort of history. So, and it was also kind of dispersed. There were different sort of ways of approaching it. There was the tantric way, there was the scholarly way, and you can imagine it being sort of, you know, very, very wild country with little villages dotted here and there with different kind of Buddhist practices going on all around. Milarepa's family was in a way fairly ordinary. His father was a trader. And was a wealthy trader. He'd done quite well. I think it said he traded in silk, actually, or wool, that was it. He was a woolen trader. So he made some money. This is interesting to compare with Padmasambhava. Padmasambhava was born from a lotus at the age of 8 years old. So a very different kind of birth, very sort of magical birth. Atisha was a monk, was a fairly ordinary human being as well. So Milarepa's father unfortunately died when he was a boy, probably about eight, something like that. But before the father died, he requested his brother that he should look after Milarepa's mother and Milarepa's sister. So all of the family wealth was left to this brother on the condition that he would look after the widow and the two children. However, the brother and his wife went entirely against this. In fact, they took everything except for one field that belonged to the widow, owned it themselves, grasped it for themselves, and then treated Milarepa's mother, himself and his sister, very, very badly, treated them as slaves almost, and said that they would look after all of the wealth until Milarepa came of age, in which time they would hand it back. So the family had to live this very, very difficult life, being menials to the aunt and the uncle and their family for a number of years. Eventually, Milarepa came of age, I guess 16, and his mother prepared the traditional feast, invited all the family together and said, well, now is the time for you to hand over the inheritance to my son. And the aunt and uncle said, well, what inheritance? Do you know, there is no inheritance. None of this was yours anyway. It all belonged to us. We just lent the land and the house and the money to your husband. It wasn't ever his. It's all ours. And, you know, so then they treated the family even worse. They would beat them, they would sort of make them do the most menial of tasks. And Milarepa's mother was very, very upset, understandably, and became deeply, deeply resentful, deeply, deeply hateful towards her brother-in-law and family. Now, what did weak people do in those days when they wanted to get their own back at someone? The only thing they could really, really use was magic. So Milarepa's mother sent Milarepa off to learn magic, to learn how to attack the aunt and uncle through the art of magic. And Milarepa, we're told, goes to a particular teacher and is eventually taught the magical rituals and brings hail. Oh no, first of all, he causes all sorts of apparitions to shake down the house of the aunt and uncle during the wedding feast. So there's a wedding feast, a lot of guests, and Milarepa causes these demons to go and grab the pillars of the house, shake the house, and it falls down. And most of the family are killed. The aunt's not killed, but most of the rest are killed in this devastation. Milarepa's mother is utterly delighted and is sort of screaming with delight about this. Milarepa returns to the village and is, of course, accused of this heinous crime and is stoned by the villagers, driven away. So he goes into the mountains and then causes a hailstorm to come down on the village, which destroys the whole year's crop. The floods carry away all the topsoil from the village's land, and the village is kind of pretty much left in ruin. Now, because of this, the villagers become very afraid of Milarepa after this. His mother, needless to say, is utterly delighted. So what about magic? It happens a lot. You read a lot about it in fairy stories, don't you? And in quite a lot in Tibetan Buddhism. In fact, in most cultures, there's this whole tradition of magic. It's only since the Enlightenment in the West, in this very sort of little bit of world culture, that we don't really believe in magic anymore. Well, I was watching a TV program not so long ago with Darren Brown. I don't know if you know him. He's a TV magician. And I was amazed at what he could do. But what was even more amazing is one program I watched where he actually showed what he'd done. He showed how he'd done this particular thing. What happened very briefly is he'd hung up an envelope in the middle of the stage at the beginning of the program. And he had 10 newspapers. During the course of the program, he got someone to choose one of the newspapers. A little later on, he got someone to choose a page. A little later on, he got someone to choose an article. A little later on, he got someone to choose a column, then a paragraph, then a line, and then a word. And, of course, the word that was chosen was the word that was in this envelope. What was remarkable is he showed how he did it. He had a camera to the side of the stage showing. And it was all suggestion. It was all auto-suggestion, all the way through. And I thought, now that is magic. What he's done is manipulated the minds of everybody watching it into believing something which they know could not happen. Now, in the Buddhist text, the traditional example of magic is a magician is said to come to a crossroads, don't know why a crossroads, but come to a crossroads outside of a village, and he makes something appear, usually an elephant, or sometimes an army. So an elephant or an army is made to appear for the people that have gathered there. This image is used a lot in Buddhism. So let's assume just for the moment that there were people who could do that. You know, they could actually make an elephant appear. I'm sure Darren Brown could do it. In fact, I might write to him and suggest that he tries to do this. Because what he can do, what he's able to do, is manipulate the minds of other people. It makes you realise how easily our minds are manipulated all the time. And in fact, I think magic is going on all the time. Our minds have been manipulated into believing this, that and the other all the time. So it's not so weird, perhaps, that what we might call an earthquake, which shook down that house, should be regarded as the effect of Milarepa, particularly if Milarepa was saying, this is what I'm trying to do. Or that the hailstorm should not be ascribed to Milarepa's rituals. I think he probably believed it himself. You know, within that sort of culture, you can believe these things. But the thing is that the incredible confidence of the magician, that he's performed some magical act, is somehow communicated into the minds of other people, and they believe that that's been done. This kind of magic, I think, is still going on, but we don't really recognise it as such. Anyway, Milarepa performed this magic. These people were killed. People were genuinely killed because of what he felt he'd done. And he had regrets. He had very profound, deep regrets. So he needed to do something about this. As it happened, his teacher also had regrets about the magic that he'd performed as well. So his magic teacher encouraged Milarepa to go and pursue the white path, to follow the path of the Dharma, which he then began to do. First of all, he goes to a teacher who's teaching the great perfection teachings. We don't know exactly what this is, but from the descriptions, it sounds as though it's something like all you have to do is realise that you're enlightened and you'll be enlightened. All you have to do is realise that you have no self and you'll be liberated. All you have to do is be entirely in the moment and you'll be free. This kind of teaching. So Milarepa says, well, that's easy. I can do that. I'm a great magician, you know. I can do something like that. So he goes away and he goes to sleep for a week. Just has a little doze for a week. And the teacher comes to him and realises that he's made a terrible mistake. He's given Milarepa a teaching which is entirely inappropriate for him. This happens these days. You know, quite often people will pick up on teachings that are entirely inappropriate. Think they've got liberated, but actually they haven't. So one has to be really, really careful with various forms of teachings. Anyway, this teacher was able to recognise that Milarepa had completely misunderstood what he was saying, and was not prepared to understand that kind of teaching. So he sent him to another teacher called Marpa. And as soon as Milarepa heard Marpa's name mentioned, he said he was overcome by waves of bliss. Just the name of that teacher gave him an intense devotional feeling. So he goes off to see Marpa. I do a meditation practice, and the first line of this meditation is it's to Milarepa, and it says, you say something like, just to hear your name brings release. But it doesn't, actually. You know, I mean, I hear the name Milarepa and it doesn't bring release. So what on earth is that all about? I think what it means is you have to really, really know Milarepa. You have to sort of have a very... You have to be in tune with him. If you're in tune with him, then it is a liberating... Hearing the name is liberating. So in some way, Milarepa was in tune with Marpa. And so in hearing his name, he felt this great liberation. He goes off to see Marpa and meets Marpa, who's ploughing his field at that time. Marpa is called the Great Translator because he's been to India several times to bring back a lot of Buddhist teachings. But, you know, generally speaking, he's a sort of gentleman farmer. He doesn't do the farming himself, but he owns a farm. And he's there. Milarepa arrives. It's a very long story, the story about their relationship. But basically, Marpa says, okay, I'll give you the teachings. I will teach you. But first of all, you have to build a house for me. You have to build a square house at this particular place. So Milarepa says, fine, I'll do that. So he builds this house for Marpa, for Marpa's son, actually. It's almost finished. Marpa comes along and looks and he says, no, I don't like it. Now, could you take it down again? Put all the stones back where you found them. Put the earth back where you found them. I don't like it. I don't want that one. I want a triangular one. So could you put all that away and build me a triangular one? So, I mean, just imagine maybe he spent 6 months on this. So Milarepa then starts building another house, a triangular house. And he's just getting to the end of that and maybe spend another 6 months on that. Milarepa comes along and says, what is this? A triangular house? No one's ever heard of a triangular house. How stupid. Why on earth are you building that? Milarepa said, well, you know, you told me to. No, you're lying. Milarepa said, no, you didn't. He said, oh, I must have been drunk. Pull it down. Put all the stones back. Put all the earth back. Start again. Build a kind of crescent-shaped house. So Milarepa spends another, more difficult, probably takes 8 months, a year, builds a crescent-shaped house. Again, Marpa comes along and says, no, it's... in this case, Milarepa got some help from somebody else to put a big stone in the corner. And Marpa comes along and says, this is okay, but didn't you have help putting that stone there? And Milarepa said, well, yeah, a few people helped me put that there. And Marpa said, no, I told you to build it, not other people. So take it down, put all the stones back, put all the earth back, and build a tower. Build a 14-story tower. That's what I want. So Milarepa starts to work on this. And he becomes more and more and more downhearted. You can imagine this happening over years. What is happening here? Milarepa is having to work really, really hard. He's having to work physically hard. You can do all sorts of symbolic interpretations of what he's building and why he's building it and what Marpa's doing. But the fact is that for many, many years, he's working hard at hard physical labour. And that is an essential part of his spiritual practice. Now, I think it's not unusual, not without reason, that at the beginning of our own movement, during the 70s, pretty much every single Triratna centre was a building site. Yeah? We took over old buildings and we didn't have any money, so we built them, renovated them ourselves, We weren't any good at it. We made a real mess of it. It was hard work. Hard work over long periods of time. And then you get one centre finished and another one starts. So you go and work on that one. A lot of us worked on several centres over the decades, actually. Hard physical work. Sometimes, you know, you think that, you know, people can't quite decide what they want to do in life. They can't really get down to anything, can't really engage with the spiritual life. Hard physical work. Walls, building walls. Particularly for men, I think. Maybe it doesn't apply in the same way quite to women. But I think this whole idea of building something, making hard physical labour, is actually a really good preparation for the spiritual life. Because the spiritual life requires effort. It requires discipline. It requires dealing with disappointments. The fact that all those houses were pulled down is very, very much part of the spiritual life. You work hard to set something up, and then it all falls down. I remember, like, just in my own life, for example, when I was in England during the 70s, I was involved with building up the London Buddhist Centre. We got it all sort of pretty much ready to go, and you thought, yeah, now we can sort of take it a bit easy and sort of, you know, kind of teach the Dharma and get people to support us for teaching the Dharma and all this sort of stuff. But then for some reason, mainly because Sangharaksha suggested it, I went to America with nothing. So it was all starting again. You know, I thought the London Buddhist Centre was what I was meant to build, but then it was the Boston Buddhist Centre. And then 5 years later, it was Aryaloka. So I mean, it's so there are always these things where you're having to re-engage and re-involve your energy. Hope I'm not pushing this too hard, but I think that's really what this period represents. It represents the preparation. You can say it's building good karma. That's one way of looking at it. But another way of looking at it is just the ability to work, the ability to apply energy and make a consistent effort, because that is actually what's required in meditation. And unless you've, as it were, developed the habit on a physical level, it's very difficult to do it on a spiritual level. Milarepa tried to give up several times. When he was building the tower, his body got so covered with sores that he just couldn't carry on. Milarepa's wife was very kind to him, but Marpa wasn't. Marpa's wife was kind to Milarepa, but Marpa wasn't. Marpa just kept pushing him to make more and more effort. I think nowadays, actually, Marpa would probably be arrested for abuse. And so we don't have the advantage these days of a great spiritual teacher like that. It's sort of, you just wouldn't get away with it. Well, probably even if you punched somebody on a nose in a Buddhist centre, you'd get arrested, wouldn't you? I don't know, maybe you should try it. But, you know, it's just, times have changed. Eventually, though, Marpa tries to run away as well. He tries to go to another teacher. That doesn't work. He gets dragged back. But eventually, what happens is Marpa decides to teach him to meditate. After years and years of effort, Marpa decides to teach him. He teaches him to meditate. He walls him up in a cave. This is the traditional way of doing it. You know, it's not just an hour every Tuesday. It's sort of, you know, 3 years in a walled-up cave of meditation. This is the traditional way to do it. You get food poked through a little hole, but that's about it. Eventually, Milarepa decides to leave that cave. Presumably, he's been there for a few years. Because he's had a dream that his mother is dying. And he tells Marpa about this dream, and Marpa says, okay, I'll give you the full teaching, and you can go and see your mother. So Milarepa's taken out of the cave, there's a big feast, all the disciples gather around. Milarepa is given all of the teachings by Marpa. He's blessed in his spiritual life. Marpa says to him, look, you've now got what you need. All you have to do is go and live in the mountains and meditate for the rest of your life, and you'll be liberated. So Milarepa's very pleased about this. He leaves and he goes off to his own village, knowing that he'll never see Marpa again. That's the end of their physical relationship. Milarepa goes to the family home and sees that the house has fallen down. The little piece of land that they did have is in ruins, and his mother is dead. His sister is wandering penniless, half crazed, through the countryside. He sits down on a mound in the house, which he later discovers is his mother's bones, with dirt and things over the top of them. He meditates there, and he decides there and then that the world has got absolutely nothing to offer him. There's nothing in the world that is of any value to him whatsoever. So he sells the little bit of land that they've got left, buys a few sacks of oats, and goes off into the mountains. He lives on that food for as long as it lasts, and then he starts to gather food from around. The only thing that's growing nearby apparently is nettles, and it is said that he eats so many nettles that he actually turns green. Some reports say that only his hair turned green, but apparently others say that his skin actually turned green. Don't know if he's, no, he's not green on either of these. He's visited by his sister and his aunt, who try and get him to come back down to the village. His sister wants him to be a local priest so that he can sell rituals and make lots of money. But he refuses to do all of this and goes further into the mountains. Gradually, his meditation and his realization goes deeper and deeper. His liberation becomes more and more realized. He becomes happier and happier about what he's doing. His joy develops. And you get the impression that over several years, his realization, his liberation, just gets deeper and deeper. At no point does it actually say he was enlightened at this point. It's much more of a gradual process. And I suspect that this is what it's really like in reality. You know, you just, you experience a certain degree of liberation, but then you kind of lose it. But then later you experience a deeper level of liberation, and so on. And so it continues. Eventually, people come by. Hunters, shepherds come by, and they're impressed by him, impressed by his spiritual quality. And eventually he starts to develop disciples, develop relationships with some of these. He often goes down into the valleys for alms, to get some food to eat. And when he does that, he meets people in various situations. He goes to various houses, sometimes stops in taverns. He just wanders around all over the Tibetan mountains and valleys, just meeting all sorts of different people. One of his main disciples was a scholar that he meets, Gampopa, who he manages to communicate more deeply to. Gampopa becomes one of his main disciples. There's another young man who's a shepherd, who becomes one of his other main disciples, Rechungpa. There's a young, we're told, a beautiful young woman that he meets at a big house in the valley called Baba Dom. And she eventually becomes a yogi. She leaves home and goes and lives in mountain caves along with Milarepa. There's another woman called Shrindromo, who's a very wealthy woman. She doesn't leave home, but she does support Milarepa and his disciples. And she often, you find her asking for teachings, and he gives teachings to her that are relevant to her as a layperson living in the village. So whoever he meets, bandits, wealthy ministers whoever he meets, he teaches in a relevant manner to those people. Although he's always got this bit of edge on him. He's always saying, you know, if you really want to be liberated, do the same as me. Go forth from the world. Go live in the mountains. Not only does he convert humans, he converts demons and Darkinis. Darkinis are sort of female figures that they can be all sorts of things, actually. They can be kind of like goddesses, but they can also be quite mischievous spirits. And there's some very amusing stories about some of the Darkinis that he meets and converts. There's one particular called Sarima, who's a very powerful Darkini, and he managed to convert her and her five sisters. So all of these stories about Milarepa meeting these non-human and human beings are told in the 100,000 Songs of Milarepa, this book of his poems. And that's what we're going to be looking at next week. Going to be looking at a few of the specific teachings that he gives and see how relevant they are to us in our life. Milarepa carried on living like this until he was 84, same age as the Buddha, actually. And then there was a particular scholar who was jealous of Milarepa having so many disciples. And that wealthy scholar sent some poisoned food to Milarepa. So Milarepa ate this poisoned food and knew that he was going to die. So he called together all of his disciples, spent the last time with him, and then went into meditation, deep meditation, and died. So that's how he finished his life. Some say that he was carried into the sky by a retinue of Darkinis, which I like to think actually happened. Okay, so next week we'll look at some of those specific teachings. We've got a few, well, got a minute. if anyone's got any questions or comments.
Chaitanya's, because obviously we don't live in a traditional Tibetan culture, so we're unlikely to go off to mountain caves or find special teachers. But do you think there's something to do with the sort of practicing within a sangha? A lot of the hardships that we might face, we're not going to go out into the cold and suffer from frostbite or anything like that. But is it? It not be along the lines of sort of having to hack out our own path and progress and be part of the Sangha. But a lot of the challenges that Milarepa faced for us, it will be along the lines of taking part in the Sangha and getting the best out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously he's a model, isn't he? He's a paradigm. He's a symbol. And most people, and well, 99.999% of people are not going to live like that. But I still think if we take his life as it were at face value, and take his teachings at face value, then they can actually have an effect on us, which will enable us to liberate ourselves to a greater degree than we might think is possible. So, for example, it's not possible. I'm not saying it might be possible for people to live this kind of life in the West. It might be. But what is possible would be to go on long retreats when one could do that. You know, where you could go into a situation where for, I don't know, a month, 2 months, 3 months, a year, 3 years, you put yourself in a situation which is almost as simple as Milarepa's. I mean, we've got a retreat centre in, well, we've got two in Spain, actually, and the one I've just been at for the last month, We have, it's up in the mountains. There are some little wooden huts, not even wooden now, well, some of them are wooden, but some little huts where you can go and do solitary retreats. They're chilly, you know, they're damp. The food is not particularly exciting. You get bored very quickly. And you can actually get something of this flavour. So I wouldn't entirely dismiss it. I think it's quite good to have this sort of ideal somewhere at the back of your mind. For some people, it's a very strongly inspiring ideal. And for some people who go and live like that, they do find, well, actually, yes, this is how I'd like to live. And then they try and work out a way so that they can actually live like that. Just, I mean, we have got facilities actually in Spain where one could live not quite as difficult, nowhere near as difficult circumstances as Milarepa, but certainly challenging.
One thing he stresses a lot is the imminence of death, isn't it? You know, he says death is going to come sooner than you think.
Yeah.
That hasn't changed, has it?
No.
Time is short. He's always saying that. Time is short. You know, you're going to die. Get on with it. Get on with your practice.
Yeah. And for some of us, it's even shorter.
Looking at me.
No, I was thinking myself, actually. Hi.
How do you avoid the nonsense in life like that? How do you avoid escapism from using that as a sort of means of escapism from the world?
Well, it is escapism, isn't it? The world is a worthy place to escape from, I think. I suppose it depends what you mean by escapism, doesn't it? If it means that you know, psychologically one is avoiding something. I mean, let me take a very crude example. Supposing you hate people, you just hate contact with other people. So therefore, the renunciant life sounds really, really good. You know, because you can get away from people and you won't have to speak to them. So you go and live the renunciant life. What I suspect happens in that situation is you'll very soon start to hate yourself. The hatred won't go away. My experience is that when I've been away from the world, the issues that I have with the world come up even more strongly and even more kind of in front of your face. Because when you're in the world, you can blame things on other people, all sorts of situations. But when you're by yourself, in that meditating, you can't blame anything on anybody. But if it's there, as it were, if it was something you were trying to escape from, you'll take it with you. I suppose that's it, isn't it? If you're practicing the renunciant life as escapism, what will actually happen is you'll take with you the problem. And it will become even more difficult in that situation. Whereas the world itself, I think, is something worthy of escaping from. We're bound to the world in so many different ways. We're tied in to so many different things that we can't feel free when we're feeling all of those pulls. So we need, at least temporarily, some kind of experience of being away from it all, so that we can experience being genuinely liberated. I mean, I know what I'm saying kind of probably goes against our gut feelings quite deeply, but when it comes down to it, that's what Buddhism's about. It's about saying that we are attached to things, and to be free, we need to break those attachments. Doesn't mean to say we become isolated. In fact, quite the opposite happens. I mean, as we see with Milarepa, you know, he had lots of involvement with people, he engaged with people, but it was on a different basis to what worldly people do, which is one of attachment. Does that
As you say, Mantravajra, sometimes it can sound a bit like, I don't know, renunciation or, you know, escaping from the world somehow means not caring for the world or something like that. And I'm imagining with Nirupa's life, it was exactly the opposite, that his motivation for practice or what happened, what unfolded in his practice, was very much to do with the welfare of the world in that sense, in other beings.
Well, I think...
Is that right?
No, I think this is interesting, actually, because a lot of people, I think, are motivated in the spiritual life by compassion, by concern for others. And I think, I mean, that is a totally valid, of course, spiritual aspiration. But other people, and I would include myself amongst those, are not particularly motivated by compassion, but are motivated by liberation, by freedom, by wanting to be free. However, I think the effect of being free is that you feel more strongly for other people. So I think more in Milarepa's case, it was more that. You know, his liberation is what gave him the compassion. They say that compassion, you know, maha karuna, is an outcome of liberation. It's a consequence of liberation. So I think, you know, one can be motivated not particularly by compassion, but still find it in the end as well. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
It's almost like you...
Is it also... I don't quite understand it myself, but I've just been practicing at a monastery in Thailand, and the founder of that monastery, Buddha Dosa Bhikkhu, he said 300 stream entrants will stop a nuclear war. Like, that was one of his quotes that he's famous for in Thailand. And he couldn't explain exactly what he meant by that, or people didn't really understand it, but he got across this thing that just the existence of 300 stream entrants in the world was enough to stop a catastrophe. And I think in Thai Buddhism they talk about the Chaitya Buddhas, but they actually, Buddhas who just practice for their own good and even get enlightened and never communicate with anyone else, and they revere them in Thailand. In the Theravada, I think that's a fantastic example.
I mean, without sort of in any way running down sort of the more sort of socially active side, as it were, I think there is, I think this idea of a sort of, well, Forrest Renunciant approach to the spiritual life is something that needs to be sort of promoted. It's not what everybody's going to do, but I think it's certainly one of the ideals there that needs to be held aloft within our spiritual tradition. I mean, I think it would be good if people that live that kind of life were as valued, say, as people that are sort of more active in the world. So it's like Reginald Ray, you know, said there's these three components. The lay component, you must have lay people in your spiritual community. You must have sort of full-timers living within institutions, and you must also have these, you know, the wackos on the edge, the Forest Renunciants.
You mentioned bohemianism, I think, before.
I have, yeah.
So is there a parallel between the sort of yogi who's just sort of living on his ideal up in the mountains, and then a bohemian that's just living for the art that they're interested in?
I would say the bohemian life is in that direction. Yeah. It's not concerned so much with social values and so on. Might even go against them. But it's pursuing an ideal. For me, the genuine bohemian is someone who's pursuing an ideal. Might be an artistic, but for me it would be a spiritual ideal without too much concern for conventional norms.